We believe that to be the true curative mode, but Mark, in introducing this to the medical faculty, we must remember that we present it in the form of a science, and not of a mere phenomenal adjunct of spiritualism. Moreover, we must present it with all the elements that constitute a science, and that at the present time we certainly are not prepared to do. We are too apartment to assume that all magnetisms that are sufficiently powerful to produce an effect are curative in their action. This is not the case. All magnetisms partake both of the spiritual and intellectual as well as the physical characteristics of the operator. When that operator projects his magnetism upon another, his psychology follows it. Let him look to it that that psychological force be pure and healthful. Though the life principle may be strong enough to conquer the disease and produce the required equilibrium, nevertheless, if the magnetizer conveys the irregularities of character, and perhaps the impurities of mind with which the magnetism may be charged, he introduces a yet worse demon than the drug disease of allopathist or homeopathist. I ask that spiritualists shall reflect upon this, and remember that it constitutes one of the grandest elements of their philosophy to study magnetism, and not only its action upon the human system but upon the human soul. Let them remember that the magnetizer possesses within himself the fountain of life but also with it the fountain of moral disease. Again, there is yet another portion of the science of magnetism which is altogether misunderstood amongst us. It is this, that there must be an adaptation in the magnetisms that are to associate together to produce health. All human beings have magnetisms peculiar to themselves, and though these may be classified, and large groups of individuals may be all good magnetizers and capable of dispensing the fountain of health from themselves to others, nevertheless their subjects must be magnetically related to each of them individually. There must be chemical affinities between the magnetisms of all bodies ere they produce the required results. And so we close these questions tonight by reiterating once again the solemn charge of old, know thyself. Surely we have entered upon one of the grandest pages of self-knowledge, when we have stepped behind the veil of matter and stand before the solemn mystery of life, when we begin to realize it by its effects, as it is pulsating in our midst in the form of magnetism, rapping on our tables, heaving up ponderable bodies before our eyes without a visible agency, when it is illuminating our chamber by the combustion of unknown elements producing spirit lights, when it is pouring its stream of strange mysterious influence on the human brain, producing semi-conscious in one direction, and exalting self-consciousness in another, as in the addresses by E.H.B. 41, State of Trance and Inspiration. When all these effects are present with us, we may study them as so many pages by which we can analyze the action of magnetism. Besides this, there are the lessons of the spirit circle with all its mysterious antipathies and repulsions, whose neglect constitutes its danger, the varied effects which the magnetisms of certain individuals produce upon others, the excess of sensibility that shrinks away from the magnetisms of some individuals, and yields control to others. Even this night we have had in our midst an evidence of the overstimulating effect of the magnetism of this platform, which has produced from its overpowering action the same effects upon the brain of the sensitive who has been removed from this chamber as partial intoxication might have done. The spiritual magnetism that controls your speaker stimulated to immense nervous force by the combined action of your several magnetisms all projected on one individual, and again by her returned upon yourselves, acts with such excessive force that this room is charged with influence from roof to floor, and to some its power is, as in the example we have witnessed, overpowering to the physical system. When you remember how little you know of the laws of these magnetic relations, manifest as are the effects, when you perceive what a grand foundation for the lyceum of a spiritual science is now open to you, you may begin to echo the words of old, "Behold, I make all things new." Still I say with the writers of Judea, "Ye men of Galilee, why stand ye gazing here? O spiritualists, why stand ye regarding these phenomena only, without attempting practically to apply them in use, without tracing the teachings of the risen spirit that soars above the phenomenal evidence of its presence? Seek for the knowledge that carries you into the realms of immortality. Grand and sublime is the foundation upon which you are building your church of the future, that broad church where every living creature shall know his God for himself, that magnificent temple where all men shall worship. But remember, it is for you spiritualists to prepare the stones ere they are fit for the final erection of this temple. It is for you, builders in this great Masonic lodge of the New Jerusalem, each one of you to bring your stones hewn, and fair and square, and true for the perfection of the whole work. It is for each one of you, whatsoever be your sphere, your station, or your principles, to cultivate the knowledge you may now attain for the practical improvement of your own soul and the general welfare of the race, and as you go hence care not to reflect upon the external form or mode of the expression that has been presented to you, but accept the suggestions to inquire that grow out of these utterances. Go hence every one of you and question what you have gained. If you answer nothing, still query what you might and will gain of the subjects presented to you by following out their suggestions in methods of study. The words which are here spoken are but goads to stimulate your own spirits to effect the work of progress which at last must be individual effort, and, above all, reflect upon the affirmation which the deepest scrutiny, the most earnest investigation will ever prove to be the noblest study of the human mind, namely man, the grand volume of creation, whose first and last page is spirit, whose interpreter is magnetism. Addresses by E.H.B., 42, questions answered extempore by Miss Emma Harding at the Winter Soirees, Harley Street, London, February 5th, 1866. The following questions were put and answered. Question 1. Will you explain your own case, as to when and how far you are influenced by an attendant spirit, and how far and in what way this influence mingles with other sources of information? And how do you recognize the spirit communication? It is of primary importance and interest to all to be made aware of the exact nature and specialty of a fact before us. Answer WHO is to prove the fact of the inspiration which your speaker is known to claim for her discourses. There are those here present, as elsewhere, who readily accept of, and believe in such facts as were recorded, 2, 3, or even 4,000 years ago, and provided they are found in the record which by such believers is deemed sacred, they question them not. By what authority do those who accept of these facts as truth, question your speaker of the fact of an inspiration of a parallel description? One arises 2,000 years ago, and says, "Thus saith the Lord." You believe it, you endorse it, and pin your soul's salvation upon the truth of its utterance. Why? Because it is so asserted in a record in which you have implicit faith, and you believe in the record because it comes from what you pronounce to be the highest spiritual source. Again, you believe in the permeation of this natural world by a spiritual world, you affirm that all mortal existence is the result of, and ultimate sin, besides being controlled by, an immortal existence mightier than that of earth. You realize the inevitable necessity for the mightier existence in your own weakness. You recognize its action and influence upon yourselves in the strength of the invisible but potential links that connect you with deity and a world of ministering spirits. All these are revelations of your own nature, which confirm the records of the spiritualism of past ages, to you as sacred and indisputable truth. And yet how much of this testimony depends on the individual witness of your own spirit? If you accept, without this interior witness, the truth as proved of any facts which were recorded in human history, without other addresses by E.H.B. 43, testimony than that of the assertion of those who were in its experience, you may accept any human assertion as truth. If, on the contrary, recorded history only becomes assured truth to your mind, when witnessed by the evidence of your own spirits, these should also assure you of the veracity of all spiritual facts. No phenomenon can ever occur in the order of nature, but that which is founded on eternal laws. God's laws never change, hence the recurrence of all phenomena require only parallel conditions to present parallel facts of recurrence. No spiritual or material facts then can ever have transpired in the order of the universe but what prove the existence of the law that subsists in eternity, and through eternity may be constantly manifesting its action, and under similar circumstances be repeated again. Those who in ancient times claimed that the spiritual power whom they worshipped, whose monitions they felt to be stronger than the perceptions of their external sense, and whom they call their Lord, those ancients who claimed in the name of the power they called God, that a supramundane existence stimulated their own natures, this inspiration which spoke with them by a voice and revealed itself to them in dream, trance, oracle, vision, and unpremeditated utterance, those are the precedents for the facts that are displayed to you on this rostrum. It is in deep reverence for God's law, in all times and all ages, in the realization that it is never partial, and in all places and all persons is sufficient for all purposes in existence, it is in this abiding faith, in the equal law and action of the Father of Spirits, rather than in presumption, that your speaker claims that a power which she believes to be an individualized spirit action upon her mediating between herself and the infinite, from whom as a source, all inspiration flows, stimulates her utterance, and by the philosophy of magnetic control, by a power which first magnetizes her organism and then psychologizes her brain, prepares by neutralizing the external form and stimulating the internal, to produce the addresses which have been given in this place. She claims, too, in this same connection that her own unaided efforts cannot control her efforts on this rostrum, and that a ministering spirit's power does. Of this claim as a fact, your speaker can give no other evidence than her word, and the inferential testimony of the great mass of spiritual phenomena, some of which corresponds to her own state, to which we have alluded in the ancient record given by those whom you accept as the authors of your religion. She has the same deific source of inspiration to draw from as had the Jews of old, the same claim to the gifts and ministrations of God's angels, the same right to demand of you the credence that you render to those whose assertions, unsupported by other evidence than their own, you accept as the divine and incontrovertible truth. Your speaker not only bases her assertions of a spiritual source for her addresses on the incommunicable witness of her own spirit, but also on the fact that a spiritual world, permeating this world, can and does under favorable circumstances effect a rapport with mortals, and that as that rapport is effected by magnetic control of your speaker, as a demonstrated subject of animal magnetism, so she is now the subject of a higher or spiritual magnetism. Magnetic control operates between the positive and negative electricities of spirits and susceptible human beings whose magnetic condition renders them receptive as mediums. Such rapport once effected, the mortal becomes, first, the subject of spiritual magnetism, by which the organism is subdued, individual consciousness in part or wholly neutralized, and its place supplied by the psychological power of the spirit. In this state the controlling and operating influence externalizes whatever latent powers are hidden within the subject. The whole rapport between spirit and mortal is affected by the laws of psychology and magnetism operating between the controlling spirit and the subject mortal, called the medium. Under the category of these laws of magnetic control your speaker ranges herself. She addresses by EHB 44, has no evidence to offer you of the truthfulness of her assertions except the witness of those who from earliest childhood to the present day have recognized that in her given testimony of spiritual phenomena on favorable occasions, her eyes have beheld the forms of those whom the world called dead. Her ears have drank in the tones of spirit voices, and time has verified the veracity of the intelligence communicated. Even in this place a witness is present who have had some proofs of these occult gifts of your speaker under yet more favorable circumstances than the last few months of her life have afforded. The facts of test mediumship and spiritual gifts have been so commonly associated with your speaker's name and experience, that it seems difficult now to prove what to herself and her associates have been long accepted as proven facts. For the peculiar character of the influence which now controls her, your speaker can render you no other definition than such as to her spiritual sense appears to be the magnetism of spirits operating on her brain, and subduing it into partial unconsciousness, and the psychology of spirits prompting her utterances. Those who are familiar with the philosophy of magnetism are aware that the magnetized subject can give forth intelligence, and frequently produce evidence of powers that were apparently utterly beyond those of that subject's normal state. Somnambulism often yields similar evidences. A partly somnambulic, purely magnetic, and somewhat psychological state is that in which your speaker addresses you. It may not be possible to prove it except to those who, familiar with ordinary manifestations of magnetic control, can realize in her case a difference both in the matter and manner of the control, which is not ordinary to herself. But beyond and above all this, she claims credence upon the fact that thus saith the Spirit, through her lips, and never until men are reasonable enough to demand the same external facts, and the same array of sinuous evidence for the support of all those systems of religion which are founded upon the thus saith the Lord of the ancients, as they seem to require for the assertion of the living witnesses of the day, never should reason and justice question the testimony or doubt the veracity of the magnetized subject of spirits, though she is unable to offer any other evidence than that of her own individual assertion. This is all of personality that we consider it necessary this night to render on this subject. Question 2. How are direct writing and drawing done by an invisible agency, as has been satisfactorily proved to have been done, in pencil, ink, and colors, when none of these materials are at hand? Answer. When you produce drawings with the aid of the materials which your senses can apprehend, where do those materials come from? They are manufactured by yourselves, out of what? Why, even of the self-same elements that furnish invisible spirits with their materials. The very pencil which your eye discerns and your fingers clasp was once in the atmosphere. The ink and pen were once portions of the unorganized ether around you, and these, by the gradual processes of growth through organic life, have assumed visible shape and form, and become substances appropriate to your use. Now, if you possessed knowledge enough of chemistry to organize in a sufficiently rapid period of time the various unorganized elements around you, your addresses by EHB45 could produce from the invisible world of elemental life, even from thin air or finer ether, every form of creation that is visible to your eyes. The unparticled elements of all being are in part here in this very chamber, and in the invisible world which ignorance calls nothing, vulgar parlance air, and science gas, vapor, and electricity, beheld in solution all the elements of organic life. I repeat, if it be possible for chemistry to produce in a measurably short space of time that which nature's chemistry produces in simply a longer period of time, why should not better chemists than men, even spirits of men, who in the realm of spiritual science becoming acquainted with nature's secret methods, can imitate them in very rapid periods of time, transcend man's chemistry, and perform its operations more rapidly than yourselves? Spirit embodied has sufficient power to compound substances by chemistry, have not spirits, disembodied, the same knowledge, with, perhaps, added powers? The action of men require for the exhibition of their transformations in matter, time and space, that of the spirits is independent of both, but both act through chemistry and force upon matter, through laws known to both. But admitting all the possibilities for the action of the spirit independent of time and space, which yourselves claim in time and space, you have the simple modus operandi by which all materials could be produced, namely, by the various transformations of matter through the three stages of solid, fluid, and invisible gas. There are many modes in which by spirit control occult phenomena are affected, and we do not find that spirits ever make use of one mode alone. In the various degrees of influence which by magnetism operate upon what are termed trance speakers, there are so many peculiar varieties, that one scarcely forms any illustration of another. Even so in the production of spirit writings without a visible agency, one of the ordinary modes by which they are produced is this. There must be given off, either from the substances connected with the local surroundings where they are produced, or from some persons present called media, an aroma or magnetic essence that enables the spirit to condense around himself an earthly atmosphere. This effected, and clothed as it were in fine and sublimated matter, highly charged with magnetism, spirit can readily control matter. Spiritual electricity is far finer when disembodied than when embodied. When controlling spirits have gathered up sufficient of animal magnetism to act upon the elements of matter, they can remove any substances that are subject to their magnetism into their own atmosphere, and they then become invisible. In all the various phenomena of stone throwing, or the projection of missiles, or objects suddenly produced before the eyes of a circle, you will find that such movements are not made with the same amount of momentum that would seem to be requisite to bring the object in its place. Those familiar with the phenomena of moving substances brought or thrown by spirits will remember that they always appear as if they were softly laid or dropped before you. They suddenly appear visible to your eyes. They are not passed through the atmosphere, obviously with the same amount of force that would be produced by projecting them with the momentum of the animal body. This is a fact which all, familiar with the phenomena of the spirit circle, will bear witness to. How is this effected? The spirit, enveloped by the earthly animal magnetism, removes within his own atmosphere the various substances he is about to use. So long as they remain in his atmosphere, they are invisible to your eyes as much as the spiritual world which fills this chamber is invisible to your sense of mortal sight. And yet the spirit world is actually here, and permeating this natural world. You assert, in the scientific systems which you call natural philosophy, that to all atoms in addresses by EHB 46, space a matter. You acknowledge that a vast amount of matter exists in the atmosphere that is invisible to you. Can you not also conceive of particles yet finer than any that have been discovered? Can you question that there must be an ultimate condition of atoms finer than any as yet known to science? Reason suggests this, spirits affirm it, and therefore it is that they may also affirm, within the range of your comprehension, that this very chamber is full of the spirit world, its landscapes, scenery, and inhabitants. In fact, that the whole realm of matter is vitalized by a spirit world invisible to you, because you only look through the eyes of materiality, and can therefore only behold material objects. It requires a spiritual eye to take cognizance of the realm of spirit and spiritual beings. Therefore, in order to make present, tangible and visible, to your eyes, that which they produce from their own atmosphere, they must pass it from their world into yours. So long as they operate upon it within their world, it is invisible, because it is immersed in the invisible atmosphere of spirit land. And so the great majority of spirit writings, performed without visible agency, are absolutely being outwrought by stances similar to those formed in your world, that is, by the same pencils, ink, paper and various materials borrowed from yourselves rendered temporarily invisible, and so either returned or suddenly produced before your eyes, when the conditions of the medium power enables the spirit to present them. This is one mode, and another is that which I have before alluded to, namely, in the rapidity of chemical operations which enable spirits to gather up from the atmosphere such elements and forces as are needful for their purposes. Although they have not arrived at that condition of chemical knowledge that enables them to render the substances they use permanent, they are still sufficiently material to prove that they possess weight, density, impenetrability, and other of the attributes of matter. All these assertions need the evidence of those who are familiar with the phenomena. When you have observed these, you will find that there is an invariability about them corresponding to that which I have stated, and all resolve themselves at last into the power of the spiritual man to do something more in science than can be effected in analogous modes by the natural man. But for the peculiar phenomena named in your question, the two modes referred to are those most commonly used for their production. Question 3. How are we conscious of continued identity, if, as it is believed, our whole frame, every organ of the brain among the rest, is incessantly undergoing waste and renewal? Answer: because we do not depend upon the organism only, for the recognition of our identity. Because our identity is of the spirit and not of the atoms, in which, as a mold, it simply grows, and becomes a temporary and transitory inhabitant of the world of matter. You may as well inquire how we are conscious of our identity, or that of each other's, destitute of the garments of infancy or the habits of clothing in which we have once appeared. As years roll on, our garments wax old and decay. Our garment of mortality is no more permanent, but year by year, nay, even hour by hour, addresses by EHB 47, is changing, passing, and waxing older and stranger to its former condition than even the work of our hands, the garments we wear, or any of the forms we originate. But does the garment of flesh any more than the fabrics we externally wear constitute the real man? It is one of the strongest evidences of the changeless, deathless, immortal nature of the spirit, that identity is never touched by the laws that affect matter. We gather up images from the first moment the tablet of memory, which we call the brain, is able to receive impressions. These images are overlaid on each other, as on a daguerreotype plate. They are perpetually being renewed, and perpetually being added to, but they are never, never destroyed. In the hour when the spirit is passing from earth, in the day when the snows of many winters whiten the hair of age, when the stronger images of manhood have become dimmed by time, and the spirit has gradually withdrawn itself from the form, and is completing the circle of existence, which unites the second childhood with the first, then it is that the reverberating echoes of time come charged to the ear with the tones of earliest childhood. Then it is discovered that nothing is wanting, nothing lost. All the first impressions which the immature brain of the child received, or its infantile memory could treasure up, are reproduced, and with these come shadowy forms which year after year has impressed upon the canvas of human life, until at last the whole picture is filled up with the complete panorama of all the spirit's earthly experiences. In the moment of violent death, when the spirit is all eye, all ear, all perception, and outward forms are passing away, the soul suddenly begins to realize the actuality of spiritual existence, and finds in the vast and yet minute records of its entire past life, suddenly reproduced in the moment of death's spiritual transfiguration, that not a grain of spirit is lost, not an atom is wanting, all is there in its perfect integrity. The spirit ever grows, but never changes. Therefore it is, that the preservation of spiritual identity, the memory which stretches away into the past, and the prophetic power which already anticipates by nameless monitions the unwritten future, and connects the spirit with the two infinities between which it is standing. Therefore it is, I say, that this very fact of self-consciousness and identity is evidence conclusive of the immortality of the soul. Chemists declare that there is nothing in nature annihilated, that whilst all things are the subject of change, and whilst every atom of matter is passing through perpetual successions of transformation, still not one is ever lost. How then can you make these theories correspondent with the bare shadow of the possibility of annihilating that self-consciousness which is one of the most inevitable functions of the soul? If you take away the fact of self-consciousness, or distrust the power of identifying others, and retaining any and every faculty which appertains to the spirit in earth life, if you attempt to quench one of the soul's functions, you pretend to have found out the fact of that which your whole system of material philosophy denies, even for atoms, namely, annihilation. Your own theories concerning the impossibility of annihilating aught that is, are witnesses, I repeat, of the soul's consciousness, its deathless nature, and eternal recognition of identities. Remove your question from the realm of matter to that of spirit, and you will never ask it, for spirit is its own witness of its own identity, and changes never. Question 4. How do you explain speaking in unknown tongues? Addresses by EHB, 48. Answer: there is in every human being a set of faculties that embrace all the possibilities that belong to spirit. Each living creature has the talent for music, painting, poetry, all art, science and intellectual lore, all spiritual attainments and affectional emotions, either latent, partially or fully developed. Spirit is a unit, and all varieties of its external manifestations are but questions of development. Hence the faculty of speech and the gift of tongues belong to all human beings alike, though in all it is shown in different degrees of capacity. But though all possess in the unitary nature of spirit the same quality of soul, all, as each, in every living creature is an infinite variety in degrees of culture of various faculties. All human beings, in fact, manifest the inward qualities of spirit through human organisms in almost illimitable variety. That which is called the brain, or the seat of the various organs, moral, intellectual and spiritual, varies in each individual. Therefore it is that one faculty that is frequently externalized, another is wholly dormant, and sometimes on predominant tendency of mind, moral or intellectual, is externalized at the expense of another. All are there, as I have said, in germ, but many are wholly obscured, while one or two alone are predominant. With some it only requires the hothouse process of magnetism to externalize the faculties which, though dormant, exist in great force and abundance.